Hi, welcome to the Asymptote Podcast. I'm Daniel Goulden. This month, we're going to do something a little different. Last week in New York, Asymptote hosted a panel discussion celebrating our five-year anniversary. We're in kindergarten. The panel featured Natasha Wimmer and Anne Goldstein, the translators of Roberto Bolaño and Elena Ferrante, respectively. It was moderated by award-winning author Frederick Tooten. I recorded the discussion, and I want to share it with you. The translators talk about their craft, how they became translators, and the challenges they face. Before we start, I want to mention that we have two more anniversary events coming up. The first is on March 23rd in London, where Carolyn Bergvall, Tenis Stevicic, and Hamid Ismailov discuss multilingualism with moderator Ross Schwartz at Waterstones in Piccadilly. And on April 13th in Chicago, Nathaniel, Jason Grunebaum, Ray Andujar, and Colleen Jordan join us for a night of performance and discussion. Tickets are available and easily purchased through Asymptote's Facebook page. We've also just started our recruitment drive. We're looking to fill positions ranging from assistant managing editor to graphic designer to marketing manager. You can find a list of all the open positions at asymptotejournal.com/join. And now, our panel discussion. The first voice you'll hear is Purna Swamy, one of our editors at large for India. She'll introduce our three guests. Then you'll hear our moderator, Frederick Tooten, followed by Natasha Wimmer, who answers first, and finally Anne Goldstein. I hope you enjoy.
Now I would like to invite onto stage this evening's incredible and esteemed guests, Natasha Wimmer, Anne Goldstein, and Frederick Tooten. Please give them a round of applause. So just a few introductions. Natasha Wimmer is best known for her translations of Roberto Bolaño's works from the Spanish to English. After graduating from Harvard University, she worked as an editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, who published her translation of Bolaño's The Savage Detectives. She has also translated the work of Nobel Prize winner Mario Vargas Llosa and recently Álvaro Enrique's Sudden Death. She won the Penn Translation Prize in 2009 and also received an award in literature from the Academy of from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her translations of Bolaño's 26666 won the National Book Awards Best Novel of the Year. Wimmer is a fellow of the National Endowment for the Arts and teaches at Princeton and Columbia University. Anne Goldstein has been translating from the Italian for more than 15 years. She is best known as the translator of Elena Ferrante's wildly popular Neapolitan novels. Goldstein earned a BA in literature from Bennington College and then studied comparative philology at University College London before joining the staff of The New Yorker, where she currently serves as the head of the copy department. In addition to Ferrante's work, she has translated Italian works by Primo Levi, Pier Paolo Pasolini, and Amara Lacus, among others, and most recently she translated Jhumpa Lahiri's In Other Words. Goldstein has received a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Penn Renato Poggioli Award. Frederick Tooten dropped out of high school to become a painter and live in Paris. He took odd jobs and studied briefly at the Art Students League and eventually went back to school to earn a PhD in early 19th century American literature from NYU. Tooten's short stories and art and film criticism have appeared in such places as Art Forum, The New York Times, Granter, and Harper's. He has published five novels, including the Adventures of Mao on the Long March and The Green Hour. Tooten received a Guggenheim Fellowship for Fiction and the Award for Distinguished Writing from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He teaches here at the New School. And now I'm going to hand it over to Frederick.
Oh, good evening, everyone. Just to say a lot of things, but one is I'm very pleased to be here with these two wonderful translators, marvelous translators. And to say also how pleased I am that translators and translation has come to the fore, mostly because of these two wonderful people. It's a profession generally unpaid, and unpaid at all, and unrecognized. So I think this is a great moment, and I hope that everyone can now feel more for the profession than they have thought about before. So it leads me to a couple of questions. I thought we'd have a kind of range of questions, and I guess to say maybe the first one would be to each, how did you get into this racket?
Well, I got into it. I was working in publishing at Ferris Strauss and Giroux, and I was helping to review submissions of from translators for various different books, and a book came in by Pedro Juan Gutierrez called Dirty Havana Trilogy. We were having a hard time finding just the right translator, and I thought, well, maybe I'll try. So essentially I got in nepotistically and unfairly, but I think that's the story of a lot of translators. And that was how I began.
Similarly, I was working in publishing at the New Yorker, and a book in Italian, the artist Saul Steinberg had a friend named Aldo Buzzi, an Italian writer, who sent a book to the editor of to Bob Gottlieb, who was then the editor of the New Yorker, and Bob wanted me to just take a look at this book and so that he could write a polite refusal about how we couldn't publish it. It was in Italian, whatever. But I read it and I really liked it, and so I thought, oh, I'm just going to try translating this, and I did, and then he published it.
Let me ask you this: what made you want to be translators, and did you have language skills in Spanish and in Italian to take on the challenge? Did you study for it? Did you train? Did you take translation classes? Can you tell me a little bit about the background?
Well, I spent 4 years growing up in Spain, in Madrid, from the time I was 10 until I was 14, and so I had a background in Spanish, and then I studied Spanish literature in college. And I always knew that I wanted to work in books, but I didn't know exactly what form that would take. And then I came to New York right after college, and I got a job at FSG. I think by the time I did the translation of the Pedro Juan Gutiérrez novel, I kind of knew that publishing was not probably the best place for me, and translation seemed a better approach. So that's how it worked out for me.
I think the idea of becoming a translator as a career choice was not something that still doesn't seem like something that people would do or should do necessarily. Mm-hmm. One of Frederick's best questions is, can you make a living as a translator? Best and shortest answer. Best question, shortest answer. Anyway, I don't think I had any. I think I really, as I said, got into it by accident, but I really liked doing it, and so one thing led to another, and I continued to do it.
When you decide on a book, you have a book, do you read the whole book first, or do you just go page by page? And what would the difference be?
Well, we were just talking about Gregory Rabassa, who famously said that he didn't read the books that he translated before he translated them, and he wanted to preserve the freshness. I have mostly read the books that I've translated before I've translated them, just because I like to know what I'm getting into. Although, as Anne and I were saying, you never really do know exactly what you're getting into until you translate it. Lately, I've been thinking that maybe I should translate a few pages instead of reading the whole book, and I would have a better idea.
I used to always read the book first, but lately there's a question of deadlines where sometimes there isn't time to read the book first. It's interesting not to read the book first in certain ways, because you get through that first draft very quickly because you really want to find out what happened. In the case of the Ferrante, the Neapolitan novels, they weren't even written when I translated the first one. Only the first one had been written, and so I was sort of working on that as she was writing the next one, and then it was time for me to start the next one when she was finished with the next one. So it sort of became its own process.
I didn't have this question prepared when we went over it, but I was thinking, what is the approach? You have a page in a language that's not yours. Do you just translate the sentence? Do you read the whole paragraph and then translate it by paragraph? Do you put it into your mind how it would seem in English? I mean, what's the process, really? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I think in the first draft, I do the first draft very rapidly. I mean, because I don't want to stop. I mean, whether I've read the book or not, I think it's the same, pretty much the same process. I do a first draft that's rapid. I put in a lot of different choices for things that I might, that occur to me. I don't try to solve any problem, or I don't try to solve too many problems. I just sort of read quickly. I mean, I read the sentences, I read the paragraphs, I read the chapters. I mean, I do it pretty quickly. And then when I go back and revise it, it takes a lot longer.
My process is essentially identical. I do think that speed is important in translating, or because you have to get through a lot of text, and being able to have a fresh eye is also very important. So the more times you can go through it, the better. I try not to go too slowly, although at a certain point, of course, you do have to go slowly.
So when you have it, let's say a kind of rough draft in English, then the issue of the music of the text, its rhythms, its particular flavor, does that come in from the redoing, the second draft, or, you know, how do you formulate? Because it's a whole other thing now. Now you have the raw material, I suppose, and then the question is, how do you make it that it is something like the original, but is also English?
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, it's a mysterious process.
Yeah, exactly.
But I am very conscious of rhythm. I do think that's the main thing that causes a translation to live in its new language. And so I'm very conscious of cadence and pacing. In fact, I would say that's what I pay the most attention to. And yeah, it's in the slower draft. But actually, even more than that, it might all be in a third draft. Mm-hmm. When you've worked through all the problems, and then you can really, fine tune it and allow it, and get it to a point where the reader can lose themselves in the English in the same way that the reader could lose themselves in the original, ideally.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say something similar, but I do think it is kind of mysterious. I mean, in some ways, the first draft, because it's so fast, sometimes has the rhythms in a certain sense better than when you start refining and start thinking about the meaning of words and the meaning of sentences. That's probably a heretical thing to say, as you go through draft after draft, it does change and it does become something more itself, I guess, more the English. It moves from one form to another.
I can say that I became very caught up in punctuation when I was translating The Savage Detectives, because it's written in something like 40 different voices, and I had this idea in my head that the syntax would mirror the character of who was speaking, and that would give it some sort of consistency, and I thought that I could see these patterns in the text. So I went through it. I went through maybe 3/4 of the novel, and then I realized at that point that what I was doing was a travesty, and had to go back again and just trust Bolaño, there are rhythms there, but they're not obvious. And it wasn't something that I could go about logically translating in a programmatic kind of way.
It doesn't hurt to translate great writers.
That does help.
I mean, it's a
that
great,
helps a
it's
lot.
A great
yeah.
inspiration just to be near the original.
Yeah.
And to feel the language. And
it is much harder to translate bad writing.
It's what?
It is much harder to translate bad writing, or your writing that requires editing and translating adds another level.
Jean-Luc Godard said that good fiction does not make good movies, but bad books make great movies. And I think that's kind of true, and obviously the language is the issue. I have some other things to ask before. We have a little bit of time. What's it like to translate the same writer over a period of years?
Well, Anne and I have both done that. Bolaño, it's interesting. We were just talking about how his books are actually very different from one another. And so I started with The Savage Detectives, which I think was actually probably the hardest one I could have started with, just because it is so colloquial and personal and autobiographical, and is told in so many different voices. And then, you know, it's told in a succession of first person. And then I moved on to 2666, which, in terms of the translation, is a very, very different project. It might seem more difficult, but actually, for me, it was easier because it's more formal, it's more distanced, it's more third person, and then, you know, each book had its own challenges. Another interesting thing about translating Bolaño is that his Spanish changes from his early books to his later novels. The longer he spent in Spain, the more Castilian it gets. And that was actually convenient for me because my Spanish is Castilian Spanish originally. So the farther he got from his Chilean and Mexican that's roots, the easier it got. So by the time I got to Little Lumpen, Navalita, or the Third Reich, was more familiar territory. But it's interesting, you know, I guess I spent 10 years translating Bolaño, and it was like sort of emerging from some long expedition when I was done.
Were you only translating Bolaño?
Pretty much only translating Bolaño for 10 years.
I mean, Ferrante's I've translated Ferrante, I guess, for about 10 years. But I've translated other things at the same time. But her writing hasn't changed. I mean, her earlier novels are in some ways, they're more concentrated and more intense. And in the later, in the tetralogy, I wouldn't say that the writing changes. The subject changes in the sense that there's a lot more history, social, there's references to society and history in a way that there isn't in the earlier novels, but I think that basically it's the same, you feel it's the same person, well, probably with Bolaño too, although I haven't really read much. But I wouldn't say that her language changes really very much. But I also think, I mean, just as an aside, I think it is interesting to work on more than one writer at a time, because somehow it gives you a different perspective. It makes you focus on the individual, on the style of each writer in a way that if you're just working on one writer is harder, I think.
What you said, Natasha, it really struck me because I realized that my writing changed from the Bronx to Manhattan. I think that I must have been writing a different Bronx English rather than a Manhattan English. Manhattan would be the Castilian correspondence there. As you're both so much aware, there's so many different translations of Proust. So my question is, what is it like to translate a writer that other writers have previously translated?
Well, that was the case for me with Bolaño, because his first two books to be published in English were translated by Chris Andrews for New Directions, By Night in Chile, and Distant Star. I didn't look at them before I translated The Savage Detectives, although in retrospect, you know, it might have been a good idea. But actually, in later, I did read his translations, and I think that we had a lot of the same ideas about how to approach him, although Chris is Australian and I'm American, so that's, you know, a certain difference. But, you know, and because he lived so far away, we didn't meet until maybe 3 or 4 years ago when he finally came to New York. And you know, it was sort of frightening, but also great. It made me feel in a way as if I were living a scene from Bolaño, the part about the critics, except the part about the translators coming together and, you know, coming together around the missing writer, Bolaño. And luckily Chris is, you know, very, very nice and extremely smart. And he's written a great book of criticism about Bolaño. So if you're a Bolaño fan, I recommend it. So in this, you know, in the case of Bolaño, for me, it's been very pleasant to have shared Bologna with Chris Andrews.
I guess I'm trying to think if I've translated. If I was thinking of a writer of that question in terms of if you've translated a book that somebody retranslating a book. Is that what you?
Yeah,
is that
I guess
what,
that's
well,
right. Yeah.
Because I've done that. I mean, with Primo Levi, I've retranslated book. I mean, books that were already translated, which is a challenge, in the sense that you think that there's another version out there that, you know, might be better. But I actually, I didn't look at the earlier translation at all, except once or I guess a few times when there were things that I didn't really understand or I couldn't figure out, like exactly what did he mean, and I would be curious to know what the other translator, in this case Raymond Rosenthal, you know, what he thought it meant, because you know, there wasn't a writer to consult.
So. Speaking of consulting. Does anyone check your translations for accuracy? I mean, it sounds crude.
Not
to say
mine.
That,
yes,
you know.
Mine. Yes, Michael Reynolds. Right.
Sorry,
here.
You what?
Yes, at Europa, Michael Reynolds checks most of my translations,
uh-huh. Which is extremely
it's
impressive.
It's really great.
No, I've never had that experience, and I, you know, it would be edifying, I'm sure. Although I have, you know, the last two books that I translated were read by the writers who speak good English. And
Bologna, read?
Well, he was not alive when I was translating.
I was wondering.
But
that,
no.
It's a mysterious trick.
Alvaro Enrique, he lives in New York,
oh,
and
sorry,
his English is very good. And also Marco Chiral Torrente, who I translated a memoir of his called Father and Son. And he also read the book. And you know, he's a very... a very particular and detail-oriented person, and it was a memoir, so it was a very intense conversation, and it was, you know, very, very edifying.
I wasn't going to question your skill, just that sometimes...
I mean, you always, in a, you know, a 400-page book, you miss a sentence, or you, yeah. You know, you mistake a word, or there's so many pitfalls that it's really... It's a wonderful luxury to have somebody checking your translation.
Maybe I have just two more questions. We can open up this discussion to everyone here. Do you get royalties for your translation?
I have mostly gotten royalties, but I you know, I've worked with publishers who tend to be very, you know, do the right thing when it comes to translations, and you know, it's a small royalty, but even if it's symbolic, it's, you know, appreciated, and hopefully in some cases it will eventually become non-symbolic. That hasn't happened to me yet. But
I have, in some contracts I have royalties, and I think it's important to have them in the contract, even if you think that you're never going to get anything from them.
Well, Ferrante must be selling
Ferrante,
wonderfully, right?
Yes, Ferrante. There's some
royalties.
You're
taking me to dinner tonight. That's what you told me.
I did.
So maybe my last question. I'm going for the from the pedestrian to the romantic. What kind of fulfillment do you get in doing the translation? Do you feel there's a kind of creative rush, a creative excitement, a kind of high, a kind of even when you have to do some dray work, but what is the other part, not just the literal work, but spiritually, what does it do for you?
Well, I think it's for people that like, someone who likes language, it's just a constantly fascinating, I mean, all aspects of it in a way are fascinating. I mean, just on the level of what does this word mean? I mean, how many meanings does this word have? What does it mean here? That's a constant kind of puzzle. Maybe it doesn't have a solution, but you do the best you can, the best, figure out what you think it means in that context. But I think also the idea of shaping, you're sort of shaping something on a larger scale. You know, you're shaping a book into giving something a new shape, and there's some kind of, that's, I guess, some kind of creative process.
So it's also exactly. A kind of moral obligation.
Well, yeah, there's that.
To do something noble for the deserving the work.
Yes, there's that aspect of it too, that you know.
Bringing this beautiful writer to life, to us.
Of course. Well, there is that. And, you know, just this desire to be associated with great works and great words. And also the sense that there are so many books out there. And, you know, I think a lot of people wonder whether translators are mostly frustrated writers, which I think is a good question. But one of the ways that I think about it is, I guess at a certain point I was overwhelmed, you know, working in publishing, and I later worked at Publishers Weekly, actually, and just, you know, saw stacks and stacks of books coming over my desk every day. And the idea that I was working on books that had already stood the test of readers in other countries, and could, you know, it really definitely deserved to be brought into English and to have a greater readership was satisfying to me. Knowing that I was sort of helping to cull and helping to help people identify what to read was satisfying. You know, on a personal level, I also really love the grappling with language. I love feeling that translation really is a skill and a craft, and you do improve, and that has been very satisfying.
And it's an art. I may presume, you know,
well,
pretentious
that
about
argued.
It. I think it's an art. I mean, you're recrafting another work into a work that never would have existed, and that has its own glamour, beauty, meaning, power. Now that I've said all those highfalutin words, maybe we should just say thank you to everyone tonight, our beautiful, beautiful translators and wonderful people, and ask you all if you'd like to have questions, address any of us, or mostly the two translators. Don't be bashful. And anyway, thank you for this.
We have two microphones, so please feel free to come up and ask any questions you might have.
Can I do that now? I'm curious what you think of the microphone doesn't work. About,
the mic is
there we go. Okay. Humor in translation, if you've translated anything that is funny, or if you can think of anything that is funny in translation, and whether you think that humor poses certain challenges for translators.
Can you say that again? I didn't quite understand. Have we ever translated anything that worked as humorous, I mean, comic?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, I think humor poses lots of problems. You know, I think it's up there with colloquial local language and being some of the most difficult kind of thing to translate. I mean, it depends what kind of humor. I mean, puns, especially. Translators love puns because it's sort of the credenza of translation. I don't know. I mean, the chapter that I read to you today was supposed to be funny. Hopefully it was a little bit funny. You know, I think about, you know, speaking of rhythm again, I do think about cadence and pacing in terms of punchlines often when I'm translating funny things. I try to make a passage build up to the joke or, you know, to the payoff. I don't know, Anne, what do you think?
I think it's hard because a lot of things that are humorous in one language are just not humorous, or situations in one language are just not humorous in another. So I think it's hard to, I think sort of trying to make it build up and trying to maybe shape it in some way, shape a humorous scene in some way that somehow gets the punchline across. Because, I mean, I'm thinking of things like Amara Lacus, who writes these very funny novels about immigrants in Italy, but the things aren't always, they're not always, the thing that's funny in Italy isn't necessarily funny here, so, but I don't know what the solution is. It's just hard.
One of my favorite writers in the world is Raymond Queneau. I'm not sure how well known he is in America. And one of the things I love about his books, profoundly love, is the way he can be serious and then weave through a kind of humor, a kind of comedy that only makes the seriousness more serious. And Barbara Wright his translator was always in that problem. How do you mm-hmm. do that? How do you show the delicacy of the wit? How do you do that? It's an incredible thing. And if it doesn't work, then our readers, American readers, English readers, don't get it. They just think that something fell flat. One of the lines I'm crazy for in the book called The Last Days, he's describing a young man coming the first time to live in Paris and go to the Sorbonne. And he's been recommended to live in a hotel, Minerva, by his parents who had not been there for 30 years. He comes from the provinces. And Canot says, he made his way slowly to the Minerva, for that's what the dump was called. Just that one word just made, that did it. Any other questions, please? Yeah.
Yeah, so actually this kind of inadvertently feeds off what you're saying about the humor piece, but I'm wondering if there's something that you're translating where so much of it requires a cultural understanding, and so just doing a literal translation, mm-hmm. if you think that won't communicate the idea to the reader in English or whatever, do you ever add something that explains that cultural piece, yeah. or do you just stick to the language part?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I try not to add too much explanation because you don't want that in a novel, especially. But sometimes you can just add a word or some kind of like slip in an explanatory phrase or something that explains like a particular reference. I mean, it's hard to if the whole scene is dependent on some cultural reference. I think that's a lot harder. I mean.
Yeah, I think it was our fellow translator Susan Bernofsky who coined the term the stealth gloss, meaning, yeah. You know, for example, if I'm trying to get across, when I was translating The Savage Detectives, there's a masked wrestler called El Santo, and you know he's not identified as a masked wrestler. How do I don't add the masked wrestler El Santo. I try to just stick a reference to a ring in somewhere or. You know, it might not even be in the same sentence, so that would be ideal.
Please.
My question relates to the Neapolitan novels, but I think it certainly relates to other translating as well. As someone who has read all those.
I'm sorry, is the speaker working? I can't seem to.
As someone who's, I've read all the Neapolitan novels in English and don't speak Italian at all, and I'm curious about. In the original writing, the use of dialect, and in the translation, there are occasionally, throughout the four novels, are certain words that are included only in Italian. I think of Camorrist and Stradone in the fourth novel, mm-hmm. and I'm curious whether that was your discretion or that comes from the original text.
About the words that are left in Italian, that's another way of dealing with a cultural reference. In a way, is to leave it in the original. I mean, to define it at the first mention and then leave it, especially a word like Stradone, which comes up a lot. And it seemed that there really wasn't a good equivalent in English. I mean, it's sort of a defining geographical detail, geographical psychological detail. And to call it the big street or the large street or whatever didn't seem. It seemed better to keep it as the one word because it had a kind of resonance. Ferrante doesn't write in dialect, to answer your question, or she occasionally uses a word in dialect. I feel like this is very squeaky. But she says in Italian, said in dialect, and then she goes on to say something in Italian. So luckily for the translator.
Yes.
Hi. So I just had a general question about it's. I think you guys have sort of talked about it, but I wrote this down, so I guess I might as well read it out. Do you set out to capture the spirit of a book? You guys were talking about, you know, the literal sense of sentences, or as well as I wrote it down. Do you tease out, like, you know? Ghosts hiding within the sentences, in the spaces in between them, or between words. So I'm highly influenced by, you know, magic realist books, for example. So there are these moments where just a literal translation or wouldn't cut it. It wouldn't make sense in terms of how things connect to each other, you know, of the phantoms that are they're hiding somewhere and then they pop out. Just would like your point of view on how you grapple that and how you try to, you know, capture those metaphors that are floating around in the text. Another sort of related question is, I've read in a bunch of places that translators can be considered writers in their own, they can be their own writers in a way because each translated work is a different work, you know? How would you respond to that? And do you feel like you're, you know, writers, you're maybe not Melanio's book, but, you know, your own book in a way, because it has your imprint on it. And it sort of connects to my first question as well, because there's also a bit of yourself that you put in that book. So,
well, to answer the last part of the question first, David Bellos, another translator, says that there's actually, everyone has a signature, scientifically speaking, and you can actually be identified by, you know, the way you put words together, the certain words, you know, the pairs of words that you choose to put together. And so, you know, so in a way, it's any book that you translate is inescapably your book, but that's a very sort of technical way to look at it. I would say that most translators don't set out to put their mark on a book. I mean, I think it's usually the opposite. You're trying to bring out the author's voice, and yeah, if you do, it's inadvertent. And that actually is sort of relates to the first question that was asked, in terms of, you know, how do you deal with what's between the lines, and how do you, how much of your, I believe, how much, I think this is the question, how much of your interpretation comes into it. I think that's one of the things that translators have to be careful not to do too much, is to clarify unnecessarily. And you might not think of that necessarily as a problem that you'd come across, but sometimes things are meant to be opaque or oblique, and it can be tempting as a translator to clarify. And you know, I think it's inevitable that that you do bring a little bit of extra light or brightness to the text in a new language, and that's sometimes why people sometimes find it easier to read translations than to read the work in the original. But if you go too far, then you risk letting the reader figure things out for themselves in the way that the author intended.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the problem for the translator is that you have to make decisions that the author didn't have to make. The author can use a word that has three or four meanings in his own language, or three or four, or many shadings of meaning, and you're certainly probably not going to find a word with the same shadings in the language you're translating into. So you are interpreting in a sense, and it is, I agree with you that you really can't, you don't want to over-interpret beyond what you have to interpret.
But it is, I mean, the interpreting is fun. It is, yeah. It is when there are, you know, when there are several permissible meanings, it is satisfying to feel that your larger sense of the novel that you're translating is informing your smaller decisions, and those things add up.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I was told that we were supposed to end before 8 o'clock. We have some time? Okay, wonderful. Great.
So this question, thankfully, is only appropriate for Ms. Wimmer. I'm sure over the 10 years of translating Bologna, you had a lot of questions you wished you could have asked them but couldn't. Is there one question you can think of that's the question you most wish you could ask him still based on that experience?
No, that's an interesting question. Yeah, there must be so many, but there is one very specific question that I would like to ask, and that I was sort of frantically asking other people, and again, it's from The Savage Detectives. At the end of the middle section, there's a scene with Arturo Belano and Ulises Lima, the two protagonists are with an older poet, and he asked them, and they're talking about the quest, you know, the quests and the literary quest, and, you know, sort of obliquely, and the older writer asks, is it worth it? Is it really worth it? And Bolaño or Belan or Lima, I can't remember, says Simonel. And Simonel is a word that crops up earlier in the book, and it's a Mexico City slang word that means yes and no. But it, maybe it means yes and no, but it might actually just mean yes. So, you know, at the very last minute, I had sort of decided that it meant yes, and I think that I may even have translated it as absolutely. And then I panicked and I thought, it's a big decision. It would really change your interpretation of the novel. The way I translate Simonel, but finally I realized that there was actually a pretty simple solution, which was just to leave it as Simonel, because it occurs earlier in the book, and you're told contextually, essentially, that it means yes or no. So better to leave it up to the reader in that case. But I am curious to know what Bolaño would say.
Someone, please.
Hello, thank you both so much for your readings. This question is actually for Ms. Goldstein.
Can you please speak louder?
Yes, sorry. This question is for Ms. Goldstein. Is that better? Can you hear?
Yeah.
So I'm really struck in the Frontes, in the Neapolitan novels, by the progression of the narrator's voice as she ages. And I'm just wondering, I get the sense in the translation that there is a real development in her narrative voice. And I'm just wondering if that's how you see that in the Italian, and whether, I mean, just in general, when you're translating a narrator that ages, is there a sense of the voice developing, and is that something that you have to tackle in your translation process?
Well, I mean, in a sense, it's her voice isn't aging, because she starts out by being, I mean, she starts out as the person, the older woman in her 60s who's telling the story, who's writing the story. So it's kind of a tricky thing to even say that it's that her voice changed, because she's writing it except for the very end, she's sort of writing it in a short period of time when she's in her 60s. So, but it's true. I mean, her voice as when she's talking about herself as a younger woman, it is like a different thing. But I don't think that I really thought about it. I don't think I think about a lot of things, maybe. I think it's there, and somehow in that transmutation from Italian into English, that translation from Italian into English, her voice is her voice in the beginning, and it's her voice at the end. I don't know, that wasn't really an answer, but I don't know.
And one other person, sure.
Sorry, excuse the whiteboard. I'm asking on behalf of a friend who's had a vocal operation. So she asks, can you describe a specific situation when you had to make a hard sacrifice of meaning or of the spirit of the piece for linguistic closeness, and what you did to try and overcome the untranslatability?
I can't think of an example, but there are many.
Sure.
If I sat here for a minute, maybe I could.
I don't know if I understand your question, but I did a translation of Baudelaire's letters from childhood, letters that went from childhood till he was 19 years old. And I remember I was translating it with my wife, who did basically the good work, and I just helped along. And there was a line of Baudelaire to his mother, because he was always pleading to his mother to love him and to come home, and that he was allowed to go back home, because he was sent to a boarding school after she married General O'Peake. So he was sent away, and even in holidays he had to stay in this miserable boarding school. I even breaks my heart even thinking about it. And the line was, mama, 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 I love you, love you, love you, mama, mama, please love me, please love me, please love me. And I said to Simona, it's too much, it's overwhelming, let's cut it out. Cut the whole line out. And she said, what do you mean? I said, just cut it out. There's a lot of it. The whole, all the letters have that stuff. Let's just minimize it. She said, she looked at me, she was ferocious. She said, "How do you dare?" She said, "I didn't stay married for more than too much longer."
Well, on that note, I think we should wrap up. Thank you all so much for sharing your words with us. Let's have another round of applause.
There's a reception now, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Before we head out there, I do want to thank our volunteers this evening, in addition to the Asymptote staff, and also the staff of the new school. And I do hope you will stay for the reception. It's right outside the table where you checked in. We also have several members of the Asymptote team here. Guys, if you're in the auditorium right now, please raise your hands. Justin Markey, assistant editor, Cara Thordeson, assistant editor, Daniel Golden, podcast editor, Naheed Patel, editor-at-large India, Bruna Lobato, editor-at-large Brazil, Matthew Phipps, communication manager, Rosie Clark, marketing manager, Daniel Shea Cook, video producer. And so come say hi to us. We really want to hear from you. If you want to learn how to join our team, how to submit, or if you really want to help our cause, we would be very grateful. Thank you so much, and have a great night.
Thank you.